Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
There we go.
Here's John Williams.
108. Boy, what a beautiful day, huh? Downtown Chicago, the skies are perfect blue. A little while ago, there were wispy white, what are those called, cirrus clouds, the little high ones way up in the sky. You had this beautiful blue with these picture-perfect white wisps way up high. And against the backdrop of, in this case, I was walking across Michigan Avenue over the Chicago River on the bridge, and I turned to my right, and there was the Trump Tower rising mightily into the sky. It's a gorgeous building, and then the blue background and the white little puffs. It looked just like a picture. It looked like a painting. It was just this glorious skyline view. I hope you had a chance to take in some of the prettiness today, because it's not going to be pleasant on Father's Day. We're planning a cookout at my place. It's going to be 97 degrees.
Is that this Sunday?
Yeah.
It always sneaks up on you. At least on me.
Yeah. You know what? When I get to be king, we're going to have a lot fewer of these Father's Day, Mother's Day, Valentine's Day, Cousin Day. Today is National Sewing Machine Day. I guess sewing machine isn't in the same universe as I'm thinking, but it just seems to me like my calendar is filled with kinds of obligations. All of them for people I love, mind you. But there's some trepidation when you get close to these and you think, oh God, did I get a card? Or what are we going to do? Or how are we all going to get together again? Didn't we just do this for Mother's Day and Memorial Day, and you got the 4th of July coming up, then there's Father's Day. I love my people.
Yeah, but this is what makes the calendar year go round. The next holiday.
I don't want to be this person that I am talking to you right now, Violetta, but I'm just telling you, there are times where I just look at it and go, oh, wow. No,
fathers are a little bit ignored.
They're
Father's
fine.
Day.
They're fine.
I know, but I just always do really forget about Father's
That's
Day.
That's fine. And speaking on behalf of fathers everywhere, we're good. We're good. You do not need to get us.
No, not my dad.
You know, really? Is your dad needy? Because here, let me finish my thought on this. If you don't give me anything, if you don't spend on me, if we treat it like an ordinary day, honestly, I think I would be okay with that. I think more men than not would be okay with that.
Really?
I think women are the opposite
of
that.
I think you say that now.
Yeah,
but
I
then
do.
You'd want a little brunch. You'd want a little baby picture throwback. Maybe a nice new tie. I don't know. My dad secretly, I think, wants to be pampered, even though he says the same as you.
You think men that say that really don't mean it or don't know what they mean.
I at least know women don't mean it when they say that, so don't listen to that.
I think that's true, too.
So I can only speak from experience.
I know. I think that, hey, listen, men, women are different species. They're different creatures. We're different animals entirely, so I understand that. And I'm on board, but I don't. But, I'm fortunate enough to have my father still alive, and I'm a father. I was talking to my sister about this. I said, Mary, listen, Mom and Dad are coming over to our house for a cookout. I know that you're going to be at your place, and I don't know if you can make it comfortably over where we live to be with Mom and Dad. I said, I'm taking you off the hook. We'll do Father's Day with the folks, and you can bump into them some other time this weekend. And then she said, okay. She was kind of thankful. She said, all right, because otherwise we've got three stops. And she's like me. Her father is alive. She and her husband are, Andy is the father of their children. So they've got to do Andy. They've got to do my sister's father. They've got to do Andy's father. And it's a lot of work. So suddenly these days that, everybody's like, oh, isn't it fun? Actually, it's a lot of work. It's either a lot of travel or it's expenses and planning.
But when you do have a sibling, it does become like, you better put that sibling's name on the card. You know, my sister was out of town for a lot of years, so I'd always be like, oh, this is from the both of us. And my dad's like, oh, okay.
Can I tell you something else weird that happened to me today? Pat Quinn, the former governor of the great state of Illinois, and a man who wants to change the way we elect the mayor of the city, is going to join us in just a second. We'll also in this, not this hour, in the 2 o'clock hour, visit with Steve Almond. His book is Bad Stories. It is one of the most fascinating current events books I've read. It's just talking about the media, the president, politics, the whole landscape of it all. And you get the feeling that the world is changing right beneath your feet right now. He talks about it in such a fascinating, easy to digest way. I know you're going to enjoy our conversation. Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country, he writes. And this isn't the Republicans are bad and the media is good. There's some of that in there. President's tweet today once again declared, ironically, having just returned from North Korea, maybe the single greatest threat to American peace and prosperity and safety, he has just declared that the press is the greatest threat to America. The president tweeted, in effect, that today. So I go buy coffee today, he said, sticking his head into the sand. So I go to buy some coffee today. It costs $2.56. Violetta, there'll be a little math on this, so I need you to pay attention. Are you ready?
Okay, can I get the number again?
$2.56 for my coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So my change is 44 cents. So I'm expecting I'm going to get 44 cents in change. As a convenience to them, they rounded the bill down 6 cents. They only charged me $2.50 and gave me 2 quarters in return.
That's nice.
I thought, boy, I know that sometimes businesses will eat a penny or two, but they ate 6, which just goes to show you how little value we have for a penny or even a nickel these days. I mean, all the guy had to do was reach in and give me a quarter and a dime and a nickel and 4 pennies, which is 7 coins, by the way, which is a lot. He didn't want to do that, so he just said, here, take 2 quarters.
So it didn't do the register, didn't pop out the number, or did he look at it and go, eh?
Oh, he knew what the change was.
Okay.
He just thought, ah, screw it, here's 2 quarters. I don't even know if he had all of the right change, because people like to use their debit cards anymore. So he just said, ah, here's 2 quarters.
You know, that's interesting that you even noticed how much change you got back, because come to think of it, I have no idea what I get back. I could get shorted all the time. I could probably even get shorted dollars and I wouldn't notice. I just stuffed it straight in my pocket.
I know what you mean. But this was in the new building and I don't normally buy coffee there. So one of my first times. And I wondered what the coffee cost. $2.56. I thought, oh, that's a little less maybe than at Argo or Starbucks. Okay, $2.56. And then I went 44 cents and he gives me 2 quarters. And I don't know if his manager would agree with that. You know, in fact, don't they have any kind of accounting at these things?
I feel like you ran off and did that thing where you clap your heels in the air.
Yeah. I slinked out before they noticed that they just discounted the coffee by 6 cents. By the way, because in order to give me the correct change, it would have required them to hand me 7 coins. The largest number of the fewest coins you can get on any change exchange is 8. I think I said that right. If the change is 99 cents, the fewest coins you can give me 99 cents in is 8 coins. So that's a lot of coins. Nobody wants to give you that. So normally they'll eat the penny there and give you a buck. The next fewest is 7 coins, and that's what it would require for them to give me my 44 cents. He didn't want to fish 7 coins out, so he just gave me 6 cents and rounded it up to 2 quarters. I know you find this fascinating. It's 1:16 on WGN. This is John Williams. Okay, we'll pause here. I believe, I may be wrong, but Pat Quinn is scheduled to join us. Pat and others, 50,000 others, think that in order to elect a mayor in Chicago, that's fine, but you shouldn't be able to run more than 2 times, which is bad news for the incumbent. I haven't visited with him in a while. Pat Quinn, John Williams, how are you, sir?
Good, John. I hope you're doing well. Last time I talked to you, your son was the star pitcher of Lyons Township High School.
Oh, then in that case, it's been way too long, Pat. yeah, he was, and he went on to have
baseball and everything else.
He went on to have a swell career at Butler University playing baseball, and And I believe that would have meant that the last time we talked, you were governor, which means it really has been too long. How have you been?
Well, pretty good. I like to volunteer for everything I can these days. I do a lot with service members and veterans and Gold Star families. We can't forget that a lot of heroic men and women answered the call after 9/11, and I work a lot with the military families.
When you were governor, you went to the funeral of every Illinois service member who passed away in service. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. Went to the memorial services and in the funerals. You know, it's real important, I think, for all of us in Illinois to remember that there were those who really raised their hand and said, take me, when it came to defending our democracy right after 9/11, and their families gave them their values. And it's real important that we acknowledge that as a society. And the best way to keep faith with our fallen heroes is to take good care of our veterans coming home. You know, things like post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury are really the signature injuries of these wars we're in, and it's important to take good care of those who have borne the battle.
More recently, you threw your name back and your hat back into the ring for Attorney General.
Yeah, well, I don't particularly like what the current president is doing. You know, I just don't agree with his approach. I think the rule of law is important to have in our country at all times, whatever your political party. So that's really what we've got to always protect. We may disagree on policies and all that, but fundamental adherence to the law is very vital to have a strong democracy.
Sure. Well, you're running for Illinois Attorney General, though. What happened there, Pat?
Well, I did my best. You know, the other side had, you know, two or three times as much money as I did. And, you know, I don't really have big shots on my side in terms of running for office or what our current petition drive is. We're doing a petition to put a term limit referendum on the ballot in the city of Chicago, where voters could vote on whether or not the mayor should be limited to two terms. Every other big city in America, except Chicago, has term limits on its mayor, and that's what I'm working on now. I was getting signatures this morning, and I believe in petition passing. It's the heart and soul of democracy, and got to get 100,000 names by August 6th to put this issue on the November ballot, and I'm going to work hard on that in the next 7-8 weeks.
We had a story the other day. I think the number was around 50,000. Where are you today? Do you know?
Yeah, well, we've gotten over 50,000. You know, we collect signatures every day, and folks are volunteering for us. Matter of fact, any of your listeners, if you wanted to visit our website, our group's called TakeChargeChicago.org, and you can visit the website, learn about the term limit referendum and petition, and download a petition if you want. And we've really had a very good volunteer response. It's all volunteer. And the way it works is if people vote yes in favor of term limiting the mayor, it means the incumbent today would not be eligible to run next year, and we'd have real competition.
So, in other words, Rahm Emanuel, who's got $80 bazillion in his campaign war chest running for re-election, in fact, would not be able to be re-elected?
Yeah, he would not be able to run, John. Actually, we have 25 cities in Illinois that have already enacted term limits on their mayor, and they generally do it in the election before the mayor election. We have the gubernatorial election here in November 6th, so if voters vote yes in favor of term limiting the mayor of Chicago, then he'll have his two terms and he'll have to step aside and
right.
Let others compete.
I understand that. And I think if you talk about term limits, a lot of people would favor that for members of the United States House or Congress or the Illinois House of Representatives. I think people at least would like to see a cap, say, on the tenure of the Speaker of the House in the state of Illinois. I hadn't thought about the mayor of Chicago, though, as being subject to these sorts of things. And I also wonder if, as close as we are getting to the election, if it's fair to do that now. You know, I mean, this is kind of pulling the rug out from underneath them, isn't it, Pat?
Not really, because they can't even start passing petitions to run for mayor until August 28th, and we have to file our petitions to put it on the ballot on August 6th. Hmm. And so they know right now we're trying to put a term limit on the mayor of Chicago. Did it in New York City, same way we're doing it, same way with Los Angeles.
Well, answer this for me, Pat. So, but I mean, we have when would I get a chance to vote on this issue. You need 100,000 for it to be on the ballot. When would I see it on a ballot?
November 6th.
November 6th. Well, when is the mayoral election?
February 26th, next year.
So by November, we could decide, which is, again, maybe right, maybe wrong. But, I mean, so we would know in November if this came to a ballot initiative, and it would be binding.
Yeah, the mayor can't even file their petitions to run for office next year until November 19th.
So I see. So that works. Yeah. And you need 100,000, and then you are asking it not to be an advisory but a binding referendum?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is not advisory at all. This is the real thing, and it's been used in 25 different cities in Illinois already, like Springfield, Naperville, Downers Grove. People have put the referendum on the ballot, and then voters vote yes or no. The whole idea of term limits, we have a term limit for the president of 2 terms, and I believe in term limits, like you said earlier, John, for all the legislators, the Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
I think it's healthy to have that because the Founding Fathers said they believed in rotation of office. They didn't want one person holding the same office for an undue period of time, and that's really the concept. And especially now with all the big money in politics where the incumbent mayor is going to have 25, 30 million bucks, and very hard to have real competition where one person outspends the other by so much.
Pat Quinn, I'm going to get you tickets to my next conversation with Thomas Jefferson because I've talked to him about this before. And
he believes in it. I have some of the quotes of Jefferson. Jefferson and Madison and, of course, George Washington, he self-limited his time as president to 2 terms. And they said that King George in England, the person we told to take a hike, he was on the throne for 59 years, and he couldn't believe that Washington would voluntarily
die.
So he did. And he followed Jefferson's lead in that, too.
Well, let's seriously, Thomas Jefferson's coming back to Chicago. He and I do a series of shows each year, usually one in the summer or spring and one in the fall. He and I are going to be on stage at the College of DuPage. I talk to him for about 45 minutes or so, and then the audience asks questions. They'll ask things about Sally Hemings and the Second Amendment and maybe term limits. And then they'll also ask him, if they want, what do they think, what advice would he have for the current president, for instance. So it's
That'd be good.
It's fascinating. And wouldn't it be fun if former governor...
I visited there. It's something. He was a very inventive man, a man of his time, and everybody has their flaws, and it's a good... have that conversation, John. I take my hat off to you. When are you going to do it at College of DuPage?
I've got it on the calendar here. It's not in front of me right now, but it's one of those, maybe the third Saturday in August. I'm going to put it on the radio. I'm going to send you 2 tickets, and if you can join us and maybe ask a guest celebrity question, Governor Quinn, that would be fun.
Okay, I'll do that. I'll bring some of his quotes that he said already about rotation of office.
Trust me, he knows them already. One last thing. TakeChargeChicago.org. If I want to sign up for the petition that limits the term of the mayor to 2 in Chicago for the city's mayorship, does that satisfy or do I have to sign, with a pen and paper?
Yeah, I wish we could do it online, but you have to do it with pen and paper. And so if you visit TakeChargeChicago.org, the website we have, you can download the petition, you can sign it, maybe get family members or friends, whatever, workers you go to work with, sign it, and then shoot it back to us. This is all volunteer, and the whole idea is to try and collect 100,000 names to put it on the ballot, and we're over 50,000 now, so we can make it if everybody does their part.
I'll talk to you again, Pat Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Take care.
That's Pat Quinn, former governor of Illinois. Didn't win the chance to be the next attorney general for the state. Still sticking his nose in the political game, though. John Williams here, 140 on WGN. Bad Stories is Steve Allman's book about what the hell just happened to America. And nobody gets off easy or unscathed in his analysis. It's spot on. I mean, it is so current, and it's so interesting in the statistics and detail that he goes into. In 200 pages, fascinating stuff, a little after 2 o'clock. He was in town, or supposed to be, for LitFest. I don't know if his flight got rained out or not, but he's going to join us on the phone a little after 2 o'clock. here on WGN. And then I think Amy Guth is going to join us because I have some splaining to do to her. If you follow me on Twitter, I'm WGN King John on all social media. Phil Vitale is in our studio. Phil, I'm going to talk to you in 60 seconds. Is that okay?
That's fine with me, John.
You can count. It's a great time to look into new windows and doors, Phil. I'm recommending Next Door and Window. That's one we went with at my place, and we're really glad we did. Here's five great reasons to go with Next Door and Window. Number five, they're family-owned with thousands of positive reviews. True. Number four, Next Door and Window's got three convenient locations, south, west, north suburbs, 25 trucks out there right now. Number three, their customer service is outstanding, complete no-pressure process. I can attest to that. Brenda and I wanted the windows in this one room. They said, well, actually, this one window is less energy efficient. And when we decided to go with what we still wanted to do, they said, fine, there's no pressure. We just thought you should know. And now we know. Number two, prior to installation, they will stain or paint your windows, fiberglass windows or wood windows, to match the interior perfectly. Isn't that nice to know? And they do it all, too. Wood-clad, fiberglass, and vinyl windows. And you can save 10% off the windows and doors with no money down and no payments for a year. Call 630-590-1380. 630-590-1380 or go to nextdoorandwindow.com. In fact, they installed our windows in that one guest bedroom that was always too cold in the winter and hot in the summer, early spring when it was still cold. And boy, did it make a difference. Got an email from Next Door and Window today, and they said, hey, just let us know if there's any problems. There was no upsell. There was no ad linked. It was just from the guy, and he said, hey, I just want to make sure you're still happy, and if not, I'll come out and fix whatever you need. Did your window or door company do that? Nextdoorandwindow.com. Phil Vitale, how are you, my friend?
I am good, sir.
Restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. I was walking Bingo, my hunchback wiener dog, over by Wrigley Field yesterday.
Uh-huh.
I was pushing him around in the G7 Action stroller, now with mesh canopy. And
nice.
A couple women came up to me and they said, you're John Williams. And I said, do you recognize my voice or me from the media?
Mm-hmm.
They said, no, you're the only guy that's pushing a wiener dog around in a stroller. We know that. You must be that guy. We were right across the street from Three Finger Mordecai, and I looked into that place. It was breezy. The first story and second story balcony were open. It's just such a pleasant venue over there. The new restaurant in
really
the Hotel
is.
Zachary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was not surprised, but very happy with how good the food is. The chef is Jared Wentworth, who got a Michelin star when he was at Longman and Eagle. Also got a Michelin star when he was at Dussek's Board and Beer in Pilsen. And so now he's been brought aboard to run this run Mordecai, which is named, as you said, after Mordecai Three Finger Brown, a Hall of Fame pitcher for the Chicago Cubs back in the early 1900s.
Everything has a baseball theme in that hotel multi-restaurant complex
mm-hmm.
over there. So that's that. What's the menu like?
The menu is, you know, all sorts of things that Jared likes to cook. They have a few baseball pubby kind of things. There's a Mordecai burger because you have to have a burger. And they have a cool dessert called a Cracker Jack donut, which is basically a Bavarian, except the cream inside the Bavarian is peanut butter kind of cream. It's peanut flavored cream. And then they have kind of the puffed stuff on the outside. So it's kind of like a Cracker Jack, but it's a donut. And then more sophisticated things, he'll do porchetta over English pea risotto. And he'll do pappardelle that's green because he makes it with arugula and then tosses that with porcini mushrooms and takes Parmesan cheese, but whips it into a foam. And that goes around the whole pasta thing. So some of the food is extremely sophisticated, and then they have something for people who just want to come in and grab a burger and a belt. And speaking of belts, they have a very, very good bourbon program there.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I think they're known for. In fact,
mm-hmm.
I walked in and I said, okay, I like some bourbon too, and the ones that I knew they didn't have. I mean, that place is sophisticated for bourbon.
Well, you know, that's the kind of place you can walk in and tell your waiter, look, I really like weeded bourbons. I'm looking for something new. I'm thinking of trying to keep it to $20 or maybe $15 a glass, something like that, and he'll come back with something.
But he'll also come back with one for $200 a glass. Literally, he will. I said, well, do you have Woodford Reserve? You know, Woodford mm-hmm. Reserve, basic kind of a nice bourbon, fine. Nah. They don't. I go, right. Really? Oh, then I'll bet you don't have Maker's Mark either, right? Nah, we don't have that. So I was a little frustrated, frankly. Mm-hmm. I thought that their bourbon program, if you're a bourbon, I guess I'm not a bourbon guy. If you're a bourbon guy, you should try this place.
Right.
But if you're just a guy who wants a Manhattan, you can get one, and it's not going to break your bank, but it's they're not catering to you there. They're catering, at least on that bar menu, I thought, on the bourbon side, to people who really want a bourbon oasis. That's what this place is.
Right, and they make a big thing. They're out in the secondary market, and they're buying vintage bottles from other sources. So they have some one-of-a-kind bottles there. They have bottles that when that last drop is poured, it's gone forever.
Well, do you think this place is too fancy for that location?
I don't think so. It's going to be an interesting balance, but really, you've got home games in the Wrigley Field for 6 months.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more if we make the playoffs, knock wood, blah, blah, blah. But they have to make their nut the other 5-6 months of the year. So that's why they need to be
accessible.
Yeah. They need to be accessible, and they also they said they're learning the dynamic between a home game and when the Cubs are out of town. They're learning the different dynamic between a day game and a night game as to who comes in and what they want to order. But they're doing a good job of getting, I think, the locals in, because absent the Cubs, that's still a pretty population-dense neighborhood.
Well, I noticed that last night. The Cubs were on the road. It was a baseball game, so some folks were watching the TVs, but they still had, a serviceable crowd for a Wednesday night, Tuesday night last night.
And you know, if you have one of those concerts at Wrigley Field, you can hear the music at Mordecai.
You do not have to pay a lot of money.
You do not have to pay the concert. You won't get me. You might not get the video, and you might not get the look of everything, but you'll get that atmosphere.
Phil Vitale's in our studio, restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about Mordecai, the new place across the field from Wrigley. And Clark, the headline in your review, which is a 3-star review, right?
Yes, it is.
Will Wentworth's cooking at Mordecai earn him another Michelin star? Did you get a sense of this? Is this on track to be that good?
I think it is, and I think also stylistically it's the kind of thing that Michelin inspectors look for in Chicago. I'm speaking out of turn because this is their gig, but they seem to have a set idea of what Chicago is in terms of what Michelin wants to recognize. And as a result, fine dining French isn't one of them. They have one French restaurant on the entire list for Chicago. They have, but they're much more interested in good, solid neighborhood type restaurants that are doing sophisticated cooking and really speak to the Midwest in terms of what their menu is about. And he's impressed them twice in a row, and he's not doing anything different stylistically this time around. So I have a feeling they're going to take a real long look at this place.
Mordecai, over by Wrigley. In fact, right across the field. It's in the Zachary Hotel Complex, and it's on Clark. It's 148 on WGN. Phil Vitale's in the studio, restaurant critic for the Trib. I need to pause. Maybe you've got a question, a comment, an observation. You want to talk to Phil or text to Phil, 312-981-7200. Your question about a restaurant, a neighborhood, 312-981-7200. You and Phil next. Phil Vitale's in the studio. Phil, I advertised that on the show today we were going to put somebody on to talk about rosé wines.
Mm.
We may end up moving that segment to Friday's show. But
that's a good day to talk about wines. It's going to be very warm out on Friday.
But I just wondered if you, and by the way, this texter says, we'll get to the wine question in a second. King John, please ask Phil if he's ever eaten at Chez Moi on Halsted.
Sure.
I guess that's a French restaurant?
It is indeed. And it's the chef that had Bistro 110 down on Pearson.
Yeah.
It's made room for Bartomo, which is now making room for some retail space.
This is the one Michelin French star restaurant in Chicago, is it?
It is not. The only one is Everest.
Everest, huh?
There's not a lot of Michelin love for French food, which is kind of odd. But anyway,
This is America. Maybe we don't like that fancy French
food. True, but the Michelin is originated in France. So you think they would have...
What was that?
I mean, you know, the whole idea was to... behind the guide was to help people who were on on road trips on Michelin tires find nice places to eat. And that's how the guide was started. Oh. So you'd think that they, but no, in any case, yes. Very lovely bistro right there. Been around for a long time. It's
Chinois.
On its second owner. Yeah, it's a lovely place.
You like that. I mean, that would be, if you'd want to try French food, Chez Moi, Halsted, not a bad choice.
Right, because it's bistro, it's brasserie, it's not super expensive French. It's you know, the classic, you know, the skate wing in brown butter and all that kind of thing.
So I may end up doing this wine segment on Friday, but I walk into grocery stores now, and they have islands built out of different kinds of rosé wine.
Right. There's been a real explosion.
I know it's a summer drink, but I don't remember summers past rosé exploding like it has this year.
It's, I mean, last year was probably a big year, too, but yeah, this year it's going crazy. I mean, I offer that. My son was over, and he said something like, oh, yeah, rosé all day. And he, without a hint of irony, he was really into it. And I'm just slowly working my way through the various rosés that are out there, because there are so many.
Is there some that you like?
I can't. Yes, but it's... I haven't done enough tasting to give you a solid answer to say, yeah, by all means, get that.
Get that label.
I mean, I like a Tavel, which is a rosé that definitely comes from France. I am, my inclinations, I'm given a choice of a couple of rosés. If I see one from Portugal or see one from France, I'm more likely to take a flyer on that one. Because it's not a trend there. They've been making these rosés for generations.
Wait a minute, so you want the rosé from California?
No.
You do want it from
France or Portugal. There are some lovely wines out there.
They're probably better at it than we are.
Well, they've been at it longer.
A lot of the bottles I'm looking at are from France in the grocery stores, and they're about $15, $16 in that neighborhood, which is about my threshold for what I'm willing to spend. My problem is I've had enough wine in my day. I think I know a good Cabernet from a bad one or an expensive one from a cheap one.
Sure.
Nobody's wine connoisseur, but... Somebody gave me a glass of a really good wine recently, and I could tell. I don't know that I would know the difference between a good or a bad rosé.
On a side-by-side tasting, you probably would.
Really?
Yeah, as you go up on the price spectrum and all the rest of it, you taste more character. A lot of the newer rosés being made now are very neutral. They're very refreshing. They have nice acidity. They go great with food. They're light enough that you can sit on the porch and just sip them and do nothing else. And
how much are you paying for your rosés?
What would you say? About 15. Yeah, under 20, certainly.
Hey, King John, please ask Phil if he has a favorite organic food-serving restaurant on the northwest side or in somewhere nearby. Organic food. I don't know what organic food is.
No, I don't. I don't. I tend not to go too heavy into we only do organic food because it doesn't necessarily tell you that it's the absolute best stuff anyway. Most good restaurants are sourcing their stuff responsibly. They're bringing in food that's been handled properly and handled with care and all the rest of it. So the organic label in and of itself doesn't motivate me strongly.
Do you have a vegan restaurant you like or a vegetarian restaurant that you like?
When, you know, well, I mourned the passing of Green Zebra when it closed earlier this year.
We were at Chicago Diner not that long ago, and that was pretty good.
Yeah, and they're still hanging in there. I really like Bad Hunter out on Randolph Street. Best name for a vegetarian restaurant ever. They're not strictly vegetarian. They usually have one chicken, maybe one fish. They have a couple things on there, but the chef does really nice things with, you know, vegetable forward kind of dishes.
Right. And Bad Hunter on Randolph.
Hunter. Right. And the funny thing is another restaurant up there called called Clever Rabbit.
Same thing, huh?
Right, and I'm thinking, Clever Rabbit, Bad Hunter, that's a Bugs Bunny Elmer Fudd cartoon, isn't it? You put those two together.
Phil Vitale writes in the Chicago Tribune, his review of the new Mordecai restaurant by Wrigley Field gets 3 stars. You can read it in print. You can read it online at chicagotribune.com/dining. We always appreciate you coming in, Phil. Thanks for saying hi to us today.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
I know what you're thinking. Where's the host? What's John possibly doing that could be more important than actually hosting his own show? I'll tell you after 2:30. It's 2:09 on WGN. Hey, it's John Williams, and we're on the air weekdays until 3, and Saturdays, of course, from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. There's a book that I've got in my hand. We had hoped that we would have a chance to visit with this author guest when he was in town for LitFest, but it didn't work out because I think he got rained out. Steve, are you there?
I am indeed.
Welcome to the show. Did you, and boy, you sound like you're sitting in the studio. You are not, though. Where are you right now?
I am in a studio outside Boston, and I should tell you that I can hear myself echoing.
Oh, no, this is a hassle. Yeah. So there's a button that needs to be pushed because it's very distracting when that happens. So
yeah,
you're hearing
my own voice.
I know, right. twice like that. Okay, well, let's fix that. I can play a quick commercial break while we hit some buttons for you. Did you get to LitFest? Were you in Chicago for your reading?
It was crazy. I was delayed. My flight was delayed 4 hours, and I wound up in one of those crazy scenes like in a movie where I say to the cab driver, get me downtown in half an hour and I'll give you a $100 tip. And I burst into my session about half an hour late, and a wonderful person, a Tribune reporter, Dawn Turner, who is one of my students at the Nieman Fellowship, covered for me and spoke very eloquently, and people were, in fact, a little bit disappointed when I showed up, which I'm used to.
I'm sure that last part of that isn't true, because your book is terrific. Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country. So how about if I take a quick break here, Steve? If we can't reconcile the problem you're having in your headphone, let's do it on the telephone, okay?
Yeah, or in fact, I can just take off my headphone. Well, again, then I won't be able to hear you. All right, I'm just putting the math together here, John. That's fine.
A lot of people do that. They go, how about if I just stop listening to you, John? But no, that won't work for the interview. So stay right there. Let's see if we can resolve that. And if we can't make it easier for him to hear both ends of the conversation, we'll do it on the phone. Steve, are you there?
I am indeed. Hi.
Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good.
Steve's book is Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country. What the hell just happened to our country? What is the purpose of that title, and what's sort of the elevator summary of your book, Steve?
Well, the purpose of the book, I think, was to try to explain just that question, like how did we get to this moment where, you know, I have three little kids, so I'm trying to explain to them, and this is, in a certain way, having little kids is very clarifying because they're not super sophisticated as thinkers, but they're highly absorbent. They kind of get what mean is. So, you know, I think like a lot of Americans, I was in a state of just confusion and sorrow, and over that was a lot of anger and sort of grievance about our political circumstance and all the discord. You know, and how a candidate, you know, regardless of what you think of people's ideology and their policies and so forth, you know, I would like to have the leader of the country be somebody with whom I would feel safe having them on a playground, not somebody who, you know, boasts about sexually assaulting women or incites violence at his rallies or is casually bigoted against African Americans, people of color, or mocks disabled people. Stuff that just feels like it's beneath the decency of people of good faith and conscience. And I don't mean that ideologically or in a partisan way. I just mean I think it's deeply sad and disappointing that is the standard bearer for the GOP and the person who was, you know, elected by the Electoral College. So I was trying to explain how did we reach this point in American history, and a lot of that is about sort of getting your head out of the news cycle and the kind of the rush of all the bad outcomes. You guys just did a story on the break about how they're, you know, tearing families apart at the border, and this, if you really step back from history, you have to realize, you know, people are a storytelling species, and the reason that you get bad outcomes politically or morally or otherwise is because of bad stories that people tell themselves.
Well, what is the definition of a bad story?
A story that is fraudulent, a story that is propagandistic, a story that's intended to sow discord rather than to encourage people to be empathic.
Okay, so what's an example of that? What is a bad story?
Race is the best example I can give you. Race is a bad story. That is, it is a story that was created that there's some kind of invisible pigmentary alliance. And it was created, John, as you know, before America was even a country. It was a way for wealthy landed white people to essentially kind of shift the target for indentured white people or, you know, poor white people away from the people with the money and power and towards some other group of people of color against whom they were suddenly pitted because there was some imaginary idea that the color of your skin puts you in alliance with other people of that skin color. And that was very overt at the time of the country's founding, right? We had African Americans who were property, right? All men created equal was kind of a bad story in the sense that it was fraudulent. All men weren't created equal. In fact, women couldn't vote, slaves couldn't vote. It was really just landed white men who could vote when the country was founded.
But is the bad story that because of the color of your skin, you're less human, you aren't physiologically or mentally comparable to people of other skin color?
That's part of it. Certainly, when you hear somebody say talk about people of color in a way that conveys that they are subhuman or less than human or less intelligent or more savage or .. That's certainly part of it. But it's also the idea that there is something called race, that people with a pigmentary alliance are somehow in alliance with one another against people with a different pigmentation. If you just step back from that story, who says so? People with a vested interest in saying so. Another bad story that's kind of foundational, since you're asking, and the book is organized, as you know, into a series of bad stories, the idea that America is a representative democracy. You know, that wasn't true at the founding of the country, and it's still not true. It's something that is something we would like to be true, and I wish it was true, but one person doesn't have one vote in this country. Votes count all differently based on what state you're in. There's a large portion of the population that's disenfranchised, and there's also a significant portion of the population, and this may be the most dire thing that Americans face, who simply don't exercise their franchise. They've lost faith in the idea that their vote matters in the system. Everybody, whether you're Republican or Democrat, liberal, conservative, whatever it is, we should all be concerned about
there,
the fact that
we should all be concerned that what?
That 104 million people didn't exercise their franchise.
Think about this. You point this out in the book that, what was it, 42% of people who could vote didn't? I think that's the number.
Right.
And of those 42%, obviously, of the 58% that voted, 58% in this election voted, of that 58%, obviously less than half cast ballots for the president. But he won. That's the system. Donald Trump knew how the game is played. I'm hearing what you're saying.
Well, John, step back from what you just said. That is the system. But what if you were here at the country's founding, or 100 years after the country's founding, and somebody said to you, don't you think women should be allowed to vote? Or don't you think African Americans should be allowed to vote? If you answered, well, that's just the system, people would look at you understandably and say, are you crazy? That's completely unfair.
Right.
A system that's rigged in the ultimate way that our system is rigged. It's rigged by wealth, I think. It's rigged to some extent by race. And, you know, this applies to the criminal justice system and all kinds of different, you know, equality of opportunity is the founding good story that America, you know, sort of tells ourselves that we were founded on.
I understand that, Steve, but I didn't read your book with the prescription coming out of it that said, okay, here's how we fix that. Here's how we enfranchise more voters or get more sane voters, if that's the way you want to look at it. I saw you as simply pointing out, here's what happened. That's the title of your book, Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country. And I think that in itself is kind of a wake-up call. I worried in reading the book that it might work a little echoey. That are independents, are conservatives, are Republicans going to look at this and go, wow, the guy's got a point there?
I don't know, but the truth is that I don't believe in bad people, and I hope this came through in the book. I believe that people fall under the sway of bad stories. So, you know, the day after the election, I was, you know, in Florida, and I was hanging out, you know, with my son in a swimming pool, and I walked by this young guy, and he had a little daughter, like the age of my daughter, who was eating potato chips, and as I walked by, this guy said, you know, oh, honey, we're about to have dinner, don't eat any more chips, and of course, the little girl, anybody who has kids knows how this story goes, immediately started eating chips even more quickly, and I laughed, and I sort of said, good luck with that. It was this moment of real bonding, like, hey, we're both dads, we're both kind of at the mercy of our daughters. And a few minutes later, my son pointed, you know, came up next to me in the shallow end of the pool and pointed to this guy and said, look, Papa, look what that man's wearing. He was wearing a Make America Great Again hat. I think my son expected me to express indignation or anger at this guy or something like that. But the truth is, John, I have no idea what led that guy to put on that hat. I have no idea what stories it is that he listens to that made him believe this guy's going to be a good leader or he's the right leader for me. All I know is that he's a dad like me on vacation. He's a fellow citizen. He's just as much a citizen as I am. And the question really that the book asks is not are these people good or bad, but what stories do we tell ourselves that convince us that this or that kind of political actor is going to be good for the country? And if we fall under the sway of bad stories, we're going to wind up with bad outcomes.
And do you think Donald Trump got elected because of bad stories? Because of information that is wrong and was manipulative that way?
Well, I do. But I also feel like that's not just the responsibility of one party or one set of people. This is a democracy. And if we have an electoral outcome that results in somebody who I feel is deeply corrupt and self-interested and is not trying to protect people beyond just the constituency that voted for him, that's a result that I have part of me, I'm partly responsible for that. It's not the sort of book that says that evil or bad intention or bad stories is just located out there on the other side. I think that's a dodge. I think, as we were saying earlier, we should all be anguished at the idea that the United States ranks 35th in voter participation, you know, behind Turkey, behind Greece. We should ask, why is it that we have made it difficult to vote? Why have we discouraged our citizens from voting? And in whose interest is it to have a lower turnout? And, you know, the answer to these questions is not especially difficult to discern. The central thing that I believe government is supposed to do is to try to protect the people, by which I mean especially vulnerable communities, from a kind of corrupt alliance between big business and government. And that applies to the gun control debate. That applies to how taxes are levied in this country. And the great eras in this country, like after World War II, the great post-war boom. I'm sure you know this, John. Yeah, the tax rate on the highest earners under Eisenhower was 90%. Yeah. Under Kennedy, it was 75%. You know, when people suggest that we take maybe one yacht from a person who has 100 yachts so that a bunch of kids can go to college, I think that's a beautiful thing. That's good for everybody involved. So I do think that, in a sense, greed is one of the central bad stories, and people leverage greed. I think particular demagogues and political actors are able to pursue greedy ends by exalting people's grievances and getting them to ignore their vulnerability.
Exalting people's grievances. What do you mean by that?
I mean, for instance, that one of the ways that you can get people to ignore, for instance, that they might need better health care coverage, that they need some help from the government to make sure that they have a medical emergency, they're not going to go bankrupt. One of the ways that you distract somebody from that vulnerability, which is very humiliating to people, is to say to them, you know what's really important? Keeping immigrants from infiltrating your community. You know what's really important? Keeping those thugs from cities like Chicago out of your neighborhoods and making sure that Sharia law...
So you're telling these people that voted for Trump that they're not smart enough, that they've been played?
Nope. What I'm telling them is that they have had their grievances exalted, and as a result of that, they've ignored the ways in which government is intended, really, to try to help them. I'm not into calling people suckers or da-da-da-da. Everybody gets their own set of stories, but I do think it's dangerous to not examine what those stories are and to not recognize that if you don't look at whether your stories are good stories or not, you're going to wind up with bad stories, and they're going to result in bad outcomes.
Is the biggest bad story of the last election that Hillary Clinton's email server was a necessary factor in the election?
I don't know about, you know, biggest or smallest. Again, I think if you just step back from history a bit, the most disturbing thing is that the person who won the election was civic apathy. In other words, you know, Trump got 25%, Hillary got 26%, the independents got a few percent. and not voting got, you know, whatever it was, 42% of the vote. I think that should be the big thing that signals that our democracy is sick, that somebody can get 25% of the eligible voters and be bestowed 100% of the power.
I understand that, and I don't think anybody's going to disagree with you that, no matter who they voted for. 42% is an appalling number, but I'm sorry, I didn't vote for Donald Trump, and as I watch his presidency unfold, I am appalled and amazed and disappointed in what I am seeing, and somebody needs to explain that to me. I still don't understand how even a fourth of my fellow citizens look at Donald Trump, his actions, his manner, the whole picture, and say, that's my guy. I must have had my head in the sand.
Well, I'll tell you, Bad Stories does attempt to explain why it is that Hillary Clinton in particular was really, I want to say this carefully, I don't think she was a fantastic candidate in the sense of being charismatic and so forth. I was distressed by her voting for the Iraq War, her buck-raking speeches, you know. If it was purely on policy, I was probably for somebody who was more redistributive in their outlook, like Bernie Sanders, who essentially said, look, we should take better care of equality of opportunity and those who are vulnerable in our communities. But I do think that Hillary Clinton for the past 35 or 40 years has really been victimized by a kind of constant scandal set of accusations. I say in the book it's as if they put a smoke machine, you know, a smoke detector in you know, wherever she goes, there's sort of a machine that produces smoke, and as soon as it does, the sirens come and there's a new scandal, regardless of whether there's anything really to it or not. And, you know, email coverage, the coverage of this email thing was about 11% of the coverage overall, and the coverage of policy, by which I mean economic policy, environmental policy, all of it, was 10%. We should all take a long look at those numbers and say, was some bureaucratic bungling about her email really more important than every other policy discussion? Elections are supposed to be a contest of ideas.
Particularly since, as you point out, okay, and then we saw all of the email, and if you think she was really hiding something fantastic, what was it? And there was nothing there. To this day, you'd think if there was something, am I misrepresenting what you were pointing out?
We would have had something,
and we don't.
Yeah, I think it was a nothing burger, and I think the treatment of all of her scandals, I mean, this is the thing. I would talk with people, and they would say, oh, she's corrupt, oh, emails, Benghazi. It was kind of like it was just enough to say a single word, and the stain would be on her. And I think it was something that people used, frankly, who, for whatever set of reasons, mostly unexamined bad stories that live within people, just couldn't stand voting for a woman or that woman or a Democrat or a liberal or whatever it was. So they constructed a story in which she was, you know, somehow mixed up in conspiracies, she was in cahoots with Russia, you know, whatever it was. I don't think there was much to any of it, but that's not really, when you're a political actor and you're trying to seize power, it's actually useful to be shameless. It's actually useful politically to not worry about what the facts are and worry instead about whether you can gin up a kind of concern and a kind of paranoid set of conspiracies against somebody. And I just feel that the right wing of this country, and especially the right-wing media, that's their entire agenda. There's no effort at epistemology. They're not interested in trying to present stories that might make us understand why we have civic dysfunction. They're simply interested day after day in kind of creating a counter-narrative in which the Republican candidate, no matter who it is always the victim, and the Democratic candidate, no matter who it is always the perpetrator. And, you know, basically what matters more than anything else in the whole world is white people and white people's feelings. It matters more than people of color, certainly. It matters more than the abrogation of people's rights. And I say that, you know, not because I think it's a great circumstance or not to be provocative, but I simply think if you really objectively look at what the Sean Hannitys and Rush Limbaughs of the world are doing, that is their entire purpose. They never say, hey, Barack Obama was trying to do something good. Hey, Hillary Clinton has some good idea.
Right.
Never any consideration of that. It's completely predicated on simply attack, 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 conspiracy, conspiracy, conspiracy. And when they fall apart, it doesn't matter. They just move on to the next one. Oh, they didn't wiretap the phones. Okay, we'll move on to Spygate. Oh, Spygate fell apart. Okay, we'll move on to Robert Mueller.
You point out late in the book, I'm looking at page 74, after the election, 48% of Trump supporters believed Obama was born in Kenya. After the election, millions of illegal votes were cast in the election. 38% of Trump supporters believe that millions of illegal votes were cast in the election. No evidence to that. 53% believed that the leaked email from Clinton staffers contained code words for pedophilia, human trafficking, and satanic ritual abuse. 53% of Trump supporters believe that. I'm out of time. It's the this and more, so much more, in actually a relatively short read for all of the heft. It's Steve Allman's Bad Stories, what the hell just happened to our country. Next time you come through Chicago, I hope it's again. I hope you can join us in the studio, Steve. I appreciate your time today.
Sure, that'd be great.
I'm King John on media, actually WGN King John on all social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. WGN King John if you follow me there. And at Amy Guth is the Twitter handle for Amy Guth. I think that's what it is, right? That's
yep.
Not abbreviated?
Just me.
Welcome, Amy. How are you? Thanks
Good.
For coming in. You and I exchanged two comments on Twitter in the last 24 hours or so. You tweeted, dude with basically my same curly hair looking at my hair, quote, damn girl, our babies would look fly as hell. Somebody randomly said that to you.
Yeah, I was at the bus stop and a guy walked by and said that.
You've got curly hair. This guy's got curly hair. He said, damn girl, our babies would look fly as hell. And then he keeps walking on.
Yeah.
I tweeted back to you, see, this is what I mean. Does this stuff really happen? Another conversation you and I will have on and off the air someday is I am always amazed at your Twitter feed and some of the things that you observe and happen to you. And I've teased you on and off the air about whether or not some of these happen, which is not to say that I doubt the veracity of them. I believe them. It's just remarkable to me that they do. And that came across ham-handed, and I think some people misunderstood it. In fact, 563 people misunderstood exactly what I meant, and I think one of them was you. So apologies if in
so
Twitter...
So what did you mean?
So, yeah, thank you. Well, there's the only thing I meant, thank you, Violetta, was that I am amazed at the stuff that happens out on the street, and you are a great chronicler of it, and it's sometimes your observations, it's things people say to you. And so when I said, does this stuff really happen, my point was, here we go again, crazy stuff is happening around Amy Guth. It didn't come across that way on Twitter.
Yeah, and you should see the things that I don't tweet. There's so many that are just so disgusting and humiliating that I don't even tweet them.
And sometimes it's stuff like this, and sometimes it's stuff that isn't about your gender or anything else. So that was where my head was, and clearly it was up my butt. But in this case, specifically, you were talking about how you have to put up with crap like this. And that is what a lot of the thread underneath our exchange is about.
Yeah, a lot of people did weigh in on that because, you know, at its core, we sometimes in the debate around street harassment, it gets down to, I was just kidding, or I was trying to give her a compliment, or, hey, why is she getting all bent out of shape? This Me Too thing is ruining compliments and interactions. But in fact, it's really about your autonomy as a human being and your ability to walk from point A to point B harassed, you know, without issue.
In the streets of Chicago. Where did this happen specifically?
A bus stop right by my home.
Yeah.
But around the world, this is something that is disproportionately affecting half the population. And it doesn't always end with just, a comment. Oftentimes, defending yourself can get you attacked, can get you physically assaulted. There's a lot of data around stop.
What do you mean by defending yourself? Saying something back to that
saying
person?
Saying something back to them, I've said something I can't say on the air, but some variation of shut up and you know, had a guy lunge at me before. And a lot of women share that experience. And so it's very important when we're talking about street harassment, it's really, really important to, not only believe women, but it's also really important to be a good ally in settings where things are happening. Because, you know, there was a lot of tweets as people were sharing today that were, there were some men talking about, you know, I walked away for 10 minutes and I came back and some creep is like all over my wife. And we saw so many of those. And so it's really not even about Twitter. It's not even about the interaction that we had. It's really this, you know, it's a symptom of this much larger cultural thing that is really this glimpse into the way women are treated very often. And that's really why I chronicle that kind of stuff.
Randomly and in public with people they don't know.
Right.
There was a phenomenon a couple of years ago where people were starting to make videos of what
right.
happens. Literally, here's what happened to me on the way to and from work. And one woman, I remember, actually posted the audio recording of what guys would say to her. I think that's how she did it. I don't remember if it was video or not, but it's amazing the sorts of things guys would say or do. A whistle, a catcall, but sometimes stuff that's much more inventive than that, like what you posted.
Right. And, you know, it, a lot of times, not only, you know, doing that can, like I said, get you into a little bit of trouble or get, you know, get someone to...
Responding to it.
Right, right. There's a lot of responsibility on the bystander because, you know, especially when we veer into the territory of the upskirt photo, which is a very common phenomenon where someone will take a picture of someone's skirt or their rear end or something like that. That's a very common thing that happens in street harassment. But often, there are lots of witnesses. That's personally happened to me. I saw someone trying to do that to me, and I turned around and a bunch of men, not with this guy, were laughing. They weren't being allies. They weren't saying, hey, that's not appropriate. They were just kind of looking on, and I know so many other women with that same experience, so I think that's a really important thing to do.
A lot
do
of guys
too.
Wouldn't do that, but they also don't step up and say anything about it when they see it happen.
Right. There's a lot of, well, I'm just going to mind my own business. I don't know that guy. I don't want to get involved because it could escalate, because it could turn violent, and that's really the reality of what you know, women are dealing with. And not just women. I mean, this disproportionately affects women. A survey a couple years ago with StopStreetHarassment.org, about 65% of women surveyed reported that they had some kind of street harassment. About 23% of it had a physical component, and about 9% of it, and that number has changed year over year. But about roughly 9 or 10% of it had escalated into, you know,
really?
Yeah, into like a forced sex act or something like that. This does happen to men, not as often, but it does happen to men. About 25% of men surveyed revealed that they had experienced some kind of street harassment. It tends to affect men in the LGBTQ community more than hetero.
Your colleague and mine, Patty Vasquez, just called in. Hi, Patty. You're on. How are you?
Oh, John. Sometimes you really make me yell at my radio.
Hey, Patty.
Are you anywhere near a telephone, Patty? We can hardly hear you.
Oh, no, I'm not available.
There you are.
I apologize. Can you hear me okay?
Unfortunately, yes.
I, so many things, John. I'm so glad I didn't see that. Otherwise, I wouldn't have even waited to call in right now. But I see Amy even said something right there where she says when something has happened to her on the street and other men are laughing, you essentially are doing the same thing by teasing her when she brings it up. And I don't tweet about it. I don't write about every chronicle, and I appreciate that Amy does. So she's like a witness for all of us because it does happen all the time. It is that nasty and horrifying. And to have her peer and colleagues teasing her about it, John, what?
He didn't mean it.
No, but I mean, that's the truth. I mean, I didn't mean what you are hearing me say.
Really?
I think you meant it wasn't.
Yeah, well, seriously, my point was that this is, you and I talked about this off the air. I don't want to have this conversation on the air because this is not what I intended it to be. It came across that way, that I didn't buy it, that I didn't believe it. I do. My point was I think it's remarkable how much of this crap you have to put up with. That was the point. But it didn't come across that way, and that's not how you were hearing it either, were you, Patty?
No, it's not the way I'm hearing it. I'm guessing there are a lot of women who aren't hearing that way.
Oh, you got that right, girlfriend.
Love you, John. Because as Amy said, you know, like even when someone just says hi to us on the street, we don't know how to respond because if we don't say hi back, we're a bitch. And if we do, we're inviting them. And every single time someone does it.
What do you say to that?
I think that's absolutely accurate. You know, I think there's the experience of walking around as a woman. You know, I do martial arts, and twice I've had to use it on Michigan Avenue. Two times in my life, and both times are right here within, like, I could hit the tower with a golf ball. I was so close, right? But both times, you know, you walk around with a certain amount of planning in a sense, you know, because any dude you walk by could grab you, could drag you into an alley, and you don't want to walk around with a lot of fear, but that's present, that's there. And, you know, both times I kind of felt something in my gut, and this guy tried to take my purse one of those times. The other time he tried to pull me into an alley, and both times I just had to strike for my own safety. So that kind of thing is always present. And again, so that's, my story is not unique, nor is it the worst.
there's so many much worse than I, you know, I'm saying.
So then what do you think when you go out onto the street later today? I mean, how present is this this thing in your mind?
I think it's quite present for a lot of women, even very subconsciously. I think we always have to think about safety in a way that men do not. You know, not too long ago, someone asked me, if you could be male for 24 hours, what would you do? And I said, I would walk around at night without a care in the world. I have no idea what that would feel like. I really don't have that sense, which is, again, not to say I'm walking around fearful, but I think for so many of us, we just have to be aware. And then language supports our fear, because after the example I said of someone trying to take my purse, immediately was, why were you out so late?
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the time my employment ends and I was walking to my home.
Do you think it's getting worse or better, or do you have a personal gauge on that?
I think it kind of ebbs and flows. I mean, right now, I think we're talking about it in a different way.
That's kind of why I brought up that video from a couple of years ago, because I thought, for whatever reason, that conversation tipped not that long ago. Patty, are you still there, by the way? I can hear your phone in the background.
I am.
I appreciate you joining us, but I'm going to let you go, okay?
Of course.
You bet.
Of course. But,
thanks, Patty.
Yeah.
I'm
surprised she's awake.
Well, her hours are about to change, so she'll have normal sleep schedule on the 18th. Patty and Andrea Darla is going to be on from 7 to 11 in Justin's slot. But I wondered if when that conversation sort of peaked or at least tipped a couple of years ago, if that would have had some sort of noticeable impact on the street for men and women.
I don't know. I mean, it's the same thing that's been going on forever. It's just in a new medium, right? It's been happening. I mean, we often
new medium, meaning?
Well, we do this on Twitter now. We do this on the street. There's so many other ways to do this, to silence women, to scare them. We see it so often, especially when men gang up on women on social media, like large groups. It's not that different than what happened when we saw in the, like, witch trial times, right? We saw, at the end of the day, women are getting silenced, and women are saying, you know what, I'm going to opt out of the public conversation because the stakes are too high and it's too dangerous for me to be there and the odds are too high. And the problem with that is that the people people controlling the public conversation are the people that are writing history. And so if you're not participating, you're not, someone else is speaking on your behalf. And so what we're really talking about is like the reality of an inequality. Because if you're walking around with any degree of fear or a sense of there are so many ramifications for what I might do next, including saying, hey, person at the bus stop, shut up. Don't speak to me that way. Have some respect. You know, you immediately risk being injured, marginalized. But you walk around with a sense of otherness that I think is dangerous for equality.
We're almost out of time. I wonder if it's more problematic on the street or on the internet, on social media or on the around Michigan Avenue.
I think geographic region has a lot to do with it. If you live in an area that's more of a driving culture, you probably see less of it than here.
No, but you know what I mean? Like you were saying how I just wonder, like you talk about how people gang up on women on the internet. If you do something on Twitter or on social media that is somehow judged badly, then you're going to get it, and a lot of people will pile on. Maybe the internet is almost worse, or social media is almost worse than it is on the street.
Certainly, because it's the good news is a lot of people are bearing witness to things, right? So when a brand, for example, makes a misstep, suddenly a lot of people are going, hey, that's not cool, that's not appropriate. I'm thinking of, I think it was DiGiorno's made a joke during the Ray Rice Baltimore Orioles, you know, when all of that was unfolding, there was a why I left hashtag that was trending, and women were giving testament to why they left or why they stayed in domestic violence situations, and that brand said because the pizza was ready or something like that. And immediately people were bearing witness to a misstep and saying that's not appropriate. But on the flip side of that, you know, it's very easy to orchestrate kind of an ass whooping.
By the way, you are normally on Saturdays.
Correct.
That's when you and I bump into each other. When are you next on the radio?
Well, I'm off this weekend, and then I got to look at the White Sox schedule because that kind of dictates my life.
Thanks for coming in. Nice to see you.
Thanks so much, John.
You can follow her on Twitter, by the way, at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H. What's up? Now, how's your day going?
Beautiful day outside if you just talk weather, but outside of that, it could get ugly.
Wow.
I'm going to let you enjoy that role.
Yeah. I mean, I. You know what? My phone blew up this morning with this.
Mine did, too.
With that?
Yeah.
With you. With John?
My phone literally broke. And somebody said to me, you mean metaphorically? I go, no, my phone broke. I wasn't looking at Twitter for a while. You know, you just lob something out and you go, oh, nobody will notice that.
Right, kind of a benign comment.
And then Elif sent me a note eventually going, you know, you got 500 comments on that stupid thing you said. I said, what did I say? I literally didn't know which one it was. I said, you mean the Hupke thing that I retweeted? No.
No. Not that one.
Sure talking about it is going to make it a lot better. So what else have you got, Ro?
All right. We have a lot, actually. We've got we're awaiting a shoe to drop in New York concerning Michael Cohen and whether or not he's going to be charged today, tomorrow. There's, you know, obviously lawyers are moving around here, and we'll just have to see here. There's a story that he's going to cooperate. I don't know that
with Mueller.
Yeah, I don't know that that's a I don't know who's saying that and why they're saying it. We'll have to see.
He's dropped his attorneys, and he doesn't currently have representation, but is talking to the feds.
Yes.
But this is the thing, because I was wondering, he's dropped his attorney that's helping him with what?
Mueller.
With Mueller.
Technically.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
But he's the guy that's supposed to be helping.
Well, it's not Mueller, really. Because he's been charged by the Southern District of New York, the federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney's Office, that is based on referral by Mueller. So they have charged him with all the stuff. Mueller handed over a file and said, we found what we believe is criminal behavior here. They picked up the ball, and they're the ones charging him, not the special counsel's office, because it's unrelated to the special counsel's office, because they came across things, right? That's just what's going to happen. Now, here's the issue. If he's dropped his attorneys, or his attorneys have dropped him, there are two different sides of this story, and he's cooperating with Mueller, is that in deference to the charges against him, the potential for charges against him in the Southern District of New York? So is he trying to get a deal down there by cooperating with Mueller?
Does this go back to the president, though? I mean, how does that?
Well, it goes back to his files, and it goes back to the business dealings with Stormy Daniels and some of these other people, and were people paying taxes, and then they found another problem there with this fellow who had been tried here in Chicago. That was a taxi cab king. And so there's some questions about that and some other real estate things. And, you know, did Hannity close on that deal? On that little ranch home he was trying to buy in Utah? I don't know. But the point is that that we don't know all the details, but we do know that there's all of this movement, and Cohen's telling people he expects to be indicted, to be taken into custody soon.
Wow.
So we're going to be watching that. We also, now this is interesting, I believe we're going to be talking to Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy.
Mm-hmm. One of the hardest congressmen's names to pronounce.
It's amazing you got elected.
Congressman.
Yeah.
He's a Democrat from the Chicago metropolitan area, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
North Coast Suburbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He agrees with Trump.
About what?
We'll tell you.